We will bring the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it's approximately 8 minutes after 2 p.m. in the afternoon on this Thursday, April 8, 2010. We do have a quorum. To my right is Senator Meyer. To my left is Senator Davis and myself, Senator Pascvan. Senator Thomas will be joining us soon, but he'll be a little late in his arrival. We have three bills that we hope to deal with today. First is House Bill 110 relating to psychologist licensing and practice. The second is HB 314 relating to workers' compensation. And then the third is HB 245 relating to optometry licensure. And it is my intent to hear these three bills today, and if it's the will of the committee, to move them from Labor and Commerce today. So with that, I would welcome from Representative Herron's office, there she is, Liz Clement. Is that the correct pronunciation? All right, so if you would please come forward and state your name and affiliation and tell us about the bill.
Thank you very much, Chair Pascvan. For the record, my name is Liz Clement. I am staff to Representative Bob Herron from District 38. Before you today sits CS for House Bill 110, House Hess. The bill's here for two reasons, basically, cleanup and protection of the public. When current law was written, the Alaska Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners offered a qualifying exam for psychological associates to be licensed by the board every 6 months. Since then, that's changed. They currently offer it every 3 months. Yet the state statute still specifically states essentially that if you take and do not pass the qualifying exam your first time, you need to wait 6 months before you try it again. The state board feels there's no reason to force people to wait that long if they're ready to take it again sooner. So that is one thing. It would create a more efficient licensure system without sacrificing professional standards or quality. House Bill 110 also clarifies who's subject to regulation by the board and who is not. Existing exemptions that are already in statute would remain for supervised psychology students, interns, and residents in a board-approved program of study, for qualified members of other professions such as licensed professional counselors, licensed clinical social workers, and marital and family therapists who do work their professions train and qualify them to do, and also for physicians who are engaged in the normal practice and scope of work for which they're licensed. Two other groups that are currently exempt but with very vague language in the statutes are clarified. The first being school psychologists who work under the supervision of their employing school districts, and U.S. government employees who practice psychology while in the discharge of their official duties. The only people subject to board regulation and the only people this bill would affect, therefore, are those who represent themselves to a trusting public as a psychologist or a psychological associate. Passage of House Bill 110 would not limit the work of any other mental health service providers in Alaska, be they secular, spiritual, professional, or within volunteer-driven programs. I believe you'll find in your committee packets 2-0 fiscal notes, so the change won't cost the state any money. With that said, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I believe we have some testifiers online who might also be available.
Yes, any questions by the committee? Seeing none, we thank you, and we do have several people that are available for testifying. We'll begin with Philip Baker. Are you available?
Yes, sir, I'm available.
Please state your name and affiliation and provide your testimony, and if you are in support of this, you can be brief and just state you support it and briefly why.
All right, Senator. Somewhere in your documentation, you should have a letter that I wrote on behalf of the Alaska Psychological Association. I am the legislative chair for the Alaska Psychological Association. My office is in Anchorage, Alaska, and we are completely in favor of this bill. We were co-sponsors of this bill. It essentially is just closing a loophole in our original bill that was initiated in 1964, because what the loophole is, any individual can hang out a shingle and call themselves a psychologist and hold himself out to the public as having that training and try to provide you know, some services of that nature, and that's not in the best public interest. There are five mental health licenses now on the books, and when we started, there was one. So social work has a license, marriage and family has a license, professional counseling has a license, and psychology has a master's and doctor level license. So since our bill was initiated, the practices of mental health services have been much more clarified and defined and scoped, and people are trained accordingly. So our bill is just trying to close a little loophole, and so that's what I would say about this, and we hope that you would support us in this.
Thank you. Any questions by the committee? Seeing none, we will go to John DeRuiter or DeRuiter. John?
This is Dr. John DeRuiter. I'm a member of the board of psychologists and psychological associates, and testifying in favor of the changes that have been well described by Dr. Baker and Ms. Clemens. The adoption of the language that is currently before you would clarify the specific exceptions to licensing requirements by the board, specifically to school psychologists who are supervised by their school district and employees of the United States government while working under that auspices. I think more specifically, this bill is revenue neutral and does a nice job of streamlining some of the requirements of the board. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. DeRuiter. Any questions by the committee? Seeing none, we move to Cam Carlson. Are you available?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Cam Carlson. I am also a member of the board, the public member on the Board of Psychology and Psychological Associate Examiners. And in speaking to House Bill 110, I would indicate that this is, I think, the third year we've been going around with this, so if you could get it done, we would love it. Spend our time on other things. As has been indicated, what this really does is get at the heart of what the board is for. The board is to protect the public and maintain high standards for the field of psychology. And if this bill is passed, it will protect who can use the word psychology in their title. School psychologists are covered, and people that work for the United States government, as long as they're working under the auspices of the United States government, and the same with the school person. They must be under the employment of a school. They can't hang out a shingle and call themselves a psychologist. So we're just protecting the public from who can advertise themselves as a psychologist, and then as a board we make sure that those people that use that title meet the high standards that have been set. So we would very much appreciate it if we could stop working on this bill and you would pass it for us, especially since no money is involved. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions of any committee members? Seeing none, is there anyone else off net that is... No one else. Is there anyone in the room here today that would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony on House Bill 110. What's the will of the committee or any discussion on House Bill 110?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Davis.
I have no discussion, but I'd be willing to move the bill out of the committee.
Please.
I'd like to move CS for House Bill number 110 out of Labor and Commerce Committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note.
Any objections? Seeing none, it is so moved. We'll take a brief recess for signing. Bring Senate Labor and Commerce back to order. The record should reflect that we had been joined by Senator Bundy, so we welcome him to the committee. We now have before us the CS for House Bill 314, and we welcome Representative Kurt Olson to the committee. And please state your name, affiliation, and we welcome your presentation of the bill.
Oh, thank you, Chair Pascal. I believe this is my first time in this committee room other than budget subcommittees. I like it. For the record, my name is Kurt Olson, representative to House District 33. Before you today, you have House Bill 314. This bill represents the recommendations of the Workers' Compensation Legislative Task Force and the Medical Service Review Committee. It's been a four-year process to get to the point that we're at today. And it involves the a significant amount of support from the Department of Labor, Trina Heikes, and Linda Hall from the Division of Insurance. So I think the credit goes to them and to the committees. The bill will establish a full fee schedule for medical services, medical supplies, injections, emergency transportation, and other medically related services. Without House Bill 314, the cap on fees for workers' compensation will expire at the end of the year. House Bill 314 also clarifies making false statements related to benefits or engaging in deceptive behaviors and fraud, and those would be prosecuted under AS 11 criminal law, and I believe that they apply equally not only to employees but employers and insurance companies. Mm-hmm. And with that, I would since I believe you want this short version, I would like to turn it over to my staff, Conrad Jackson, and Linda Hall for technical questions.
Thank you, Representative Olson, and we would invite then your staff. Conrad, please.
Senator Pestvan, good morning or good afternoon, and members of the committee. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. I have to admit that my boss stole most of my thunder, and so I'm glad that Ms. Hall is up here to get into a little more of the details and the depth and some of the history and the reasoning for the importance of this bill. As Representative Olson stated, last year we were before you with the bill that extended the cap on the medical services fees. That cap does expire at the end of this year. If something is not done and that cap goes away, I'll just leave it at that. This bill sets up an updated up-to-date, I should say, more modern way of dealing with a fee schedule, and I think that through the course of the committee hearings over the last couple of months, we've worked with a number of stakeholders. Everybody seems to be pretty happy with the version of the bill that that is before the committee today, the Finance CS, which is version / E. And I'll just let Ms. Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance, take it from there.
Before we do that, I would, are there any questions of Mr. Jackson, any of the committee members? Seeing none, we will welcome Linda Hall again to this committee. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. Both the sponsor and the sponsor staff have given you some history. I will try to keep my remarks short and entertain questions if you have them. Just a really brief synopsis of the history. It goes back to 2005 and the revisions that were made to the Workers' Compensation Act. At that time, the basis for the Workers' Compensation Board to adopt a fee schedule was pretty much inadvertently left out of the statute, but with the expectation that by the end of 2007 there would be a new fee schedule. That did not occur, and as a result, fees were frozen. The provider fee schedule was frozen until August of 2007. Subsequently, we've done two CPI type increases, but the fee schedule has remained the same. And as Mr. Jackson said, that fee schedule expires on December 31st, 2010, which would mean there would be no caps on fees at all for providers. I've included, I believe you have in your packet, some charts. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with them. They're pretty self-explanatory. But my purpose for including them is showing that we already have in Alaska the highest percentage of our system is in medical cost. The first slide is titled, well, in the little title, Claims All States. 58% of the cost of the work comp system in most states nationally is 58%. In Alaska, slide 2 shows that cost is 72%. 72 cents of every dollar that goes for system cost is in medical care. And my concern with that is the cost, as the cost of medical care goes up, the subsequent cost of claims goes up, and that drives work comp premiums. Chart 3 shows the average cost of a claim countrywide versus Alaska. Average countrywide cost of a claim is $26,000. In Alaska, the average cost of a claim is $40,000. And the last chart, I think all of you have seen at some point or another, Alaska ranks number one on the premium rate ranking chart, not a place we want to be number one. And the reason I bring these to your attention are merely to stress the importance of having a fee schedule that is sustainable. This bill will replace the current fee schedule with an up-to-date methodology. We have today probably, I believe, we're missing about 2,000 procedure codes because we haven't updated the schedule itself. Those 2,000 missing codes are paid at 100%. So when we put the fee schedule back in, those will be subject to billable charges in the 90th percentile. This is not a fix. This is not really going to lower premiums, but it does at least give us a complete medical fee schedule with all the terminology, all of the procedure codes. And it will be developed. The idea is it will be developed again by a vendor. That vendor, the only one we're aware of, is Ingenix, and I will talk about that with the bill. The other section of the bill, there's really only two basic parts, is an updating the fraud prosecution language. Work comp fraud also adds to the cost of the system. The investigative authority and prosecution authority was added to the work comp code in 2005. Recent experience, however, has shown that the fraud prosecution language is insufficient to actually prosecute. So this bill also contains, I'll explain what it actually does, but it contains language to allow prosecution of work comp fraud where it exists. The section one of the bill is the actual fee schedule language. There is an addition near the end that is bolded, and really it provides a base fee schedule that's still based on usual, customary, and reasonable charges. It requires that that fee schedule be based on statistically credible profile of billed charges. And these billed charges are actually based on Alaska charges. As I said, the only vendor that we're aware of is called Ingenix. They currently provide fee schedules for many of the health insurers. And they, I would emphasize, they're using Alaska data. They base it on geographical areas. They group together actual charges. And so today we have three different geographical areas, so there are also cost differences reflected that way. Then those charges, the fee schedule is based at the 90th percentile of those charges. The bill also requires, for the first time, inclusions of procedure codes for medical supplies, including emergency transportation. One of the areas where we're seeing a real increase in cost is in transportation related to medical cases. We're seeing that both in health insurance and in workers' compensation. So we are asking that be included in this fee schedule for the first time. Section 2, again, I believe as the sponsor said, clarifies that a crime of knowingly making false benefit statements, assisting in making false submissions, misclassifying employees is prosecuted under AS 11, which is our criminal code. And it does apply. Employees, employers, providers, insurers, whoever promulgates a fraud in the work comp arena can be prosecuted under AS 11. The prior language had a mixture of civil liability and criminal liability in the same paragraph, and that's what had caused one of the problems with the prosecution. The civil liability remains. It was actually clarified in this judicial CS. It provides that a civil action, there can be an award of 3 times the compensatory damages and reasonable attorney fees. But we've just separated them to make sure one section is criminal, one section is civil. And with that, I would certainly entertain any questions.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did I hear correctly that the average claim was 20-some thousand in lower 48 and 40, about double up here?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that would be correct.
Yeah. I remember reading in the paper a while back that they had 3 or 4 typical procedures, and they were either double or triple what they would have been comparable procedures in lower 48. And the worker comp, or the codes, as you've indicated, they're just based on average market price. So nothing in this will do anything to control the cost of procedures. Would it be accurate then to say that our worker comp costs to buy workers' comp insurance would be approximately double it would be in the lower 48?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I think the information you're referring to is a study that the Division of Insurance actually did comparing costs of specific procedures between Alaska and Washington, and we found as we looked at particular procedures some vastly varying charges. Those same types of things we find in workers' compensation, but I think you can see from the premium chart that there are other pieces to the system cost, so our premiums are not double. But if we look at, from the bottom, at an index rate of 1.08 to our index rate of 3.97, that's really 4 times as much as North Dakota. Mm-hmm. So it certainly has an impact on our cost.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Certainly.
Yeah, it may well be it's harder to injure Norwegians than it is Alaskans. I don't know. But you mentioned the travel costs. And is that a factor in our geographically spread out state like this? Is that a major factor in our comp claims?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy. Now the transportation costs I'm referring to can be just within our state, or it can be out of state. I mean, depending upon the nature of an injury and how life-threatening it may be, what type of treatment, it could be transportation out of state. There certainly are medevacs that go out of state. But we're seeing increases even in land transportation. So it's not just out-of-state transportation. But where we're really seeing the increases in costs is in some type of emergency transportation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was because of the doubling. I didn't want to all just blame doctors with 2 airplanes. I wanted to suggest that perhaps because of our geographic nature, that the travel was a factor. How much of a factor, I don't suppose you know, but it is a factor.
Through the chair, no, I really don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Meyer.
Chairman, thank you. Linda, thank you for your testimony. So we changed this back in 2005. Is that when we did this?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, yes.
Okay, and we did that because workers' comp costs were high and businesses were complaining. So I guess my question is, have we done anything to reduce the workers' comp costs? Are they getting worse, or what are we doing?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, back in 2005, we made some changes to the system that were intended to have some costs and some effect, on system costs over time. That was the year in which we created the Appeals Commission in lieu of going to Superior Court to the beginning step of appealing a workers' compensation board decision. There were a number of changes that were made at that time. Certainly, I believe that the impetus for much of that is the cost of our system. We had some significant premium increases. I approved the premium increases based on what I saw in loss ratios. At the time we started some of that work, I was seeing loss, and I don't want to use a term, but I'm going to, and I'll explain it. Most of you have heard me explain it. A loss ratio of in excess of 150% at times. We were at a period at one point where for every dollar of premium, $1.57 was being paid out in workers' compensation claims. And I approved at that time some fairly significant premium increases to accommodate that. Subsequent to that, I mean, we do public rate hearings on workers' compensation premiums. It is the only premium for which we actually have a public hearing. We have seen a tremendous decrease in frequency, which means we have fewer claims, much greater emphasis on safety in the workplace, which is certainly a result that we wanted. That in itself has helped us lower our claims cost. Today, we have had, I think, for the last 3 years, a rate decrease. I certainly can't anticipate that that will continue, but we've had a safer environment and thus been able to absorb the increases in the cost per claim by the fact that we have fewer claims. At some point, that will balance out, but we haven't done any dramatic things that would decrease the cost of our system, no. There was an excellent report, I believe all of you received, done by the Medical Services Review Committee, chaired by Director Heike's last year and put out in late November. And that committee made recommendations for things that they felt would be beneficial to the system that might help bring costs down and make some changes, but that has not been put forward at this time.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If I could just
I want to make sure that the record is accurate. Senator Thomas has joined us and has been with us for quite some time, and I just wanted to make sure that the record reflect that. Senator Meyer, please continue.
Yeah, thank you. I was just going to comment that there certainly does seem to be an emphasis in the private sector to, especially in the private sector, to reduce costs, to work safely. And I know the oil companies anyway are requiring their contractors to also have a good safety record and safety programs and et cetera. So that's been good, not only to help, of course, keep the employees safe, which is the number one priority, but also sounds like it kept the costs anyway, workers' comp costs stable, or maybe even, as you said, have gone down a little bit. So in that sense, we've been successful. You support this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I absolutely do.
Okay. I think that's the first time we've heard from the administration that they're not neutral, so that's great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Point well taken, Senator Myers. Any further questions of Linda Hall by any committee member? Seeing none, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to make sure I'm clear. On a couple of issues, one being the safety programs, and Senator Meyer is correct. A lot of work has been done on that to the point where I think, and I can't quote Alyeska's safety record, but I think they had zero lost time accidents in the last million man hours. Maybe you're more familiar with individual ones or not, because that's a big one, and they've worked at it very hard. In the North Slope, they've done the same. So I guess the question was, and I was reading this another section, and Has the rate been reduced? Have rates been reduced, or just flattened out, or just slowed the increase, or what is the general trend? I'm sorry, you may have just commented on that, and I was reading something else.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, rates have decreased. We went from a high of, I hate to say this out loud, I approved a rate increase of an additional overall 22%. And we had increases for 2 years after that, not of that magnitude, but still in double digits. And for the last 3 years, we have actually had rate decreases. So I think our work comp rates today on average are probably pretty equivalent to where they were in the early 1990s. I don't have that chart with me, but we keep track of that flow. So our rates today are considerably less than they would have been like in 2000. So they have gone down. They're still high, and as you can see from the information here, there we have the highest work comp rates. We also have the highest health insurance premiums in the country. For same cost drivers. The cost of health care drives both.
Senator Thomas.
And that was the other part of my question, was the correlation between various things. Is there a chart, so to speak, on how that works out, you know, the cost of health care versus the number of accidents per classification of a worker kind of thing? Is it that you guys take a look at that and see if people's requests for increases in rates correspond, and what percentage of it is based on a particular aspect?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, our statistical agent, the National Council on Compensation, keeps an incredible amount of data. They require data from insurers. They track various trends. When we get they make the original rate filing with us, and it's about this deep. So, I mean, it takes into consideration a variety of things. It's based on actuarial analysis. I have an actuary on staff, and we look at those things, and I could probably provide you a lot of that kind of detail if you'd like, which correlates with age of workforce, average salaries, how that interrelates with work comp claims and premiums. So there's an incredible amount of data, and yes, we do review that very carefully. And I mentioned, I think maybe before you were here, it's the only insurance rate for which we have public rate hearings, and we sometimes, somewhat jokingly but not totally, refer them as the dueling actuaries. So, I mean, we do take testimony, and it's something we do with a great deal of care, because it impacts every employer in the state, and it's an important facet of what we do.
Okay. And just one last thing, if I might here.
Certainly.
That's just to make sure I'm also clear on the changes in the addition of the Section 3. That is for civil action, and the previous paragraph A would be for criminal. Is that correct? Am I reading that correctly? That was the purpose, was to separate them somewhat, is my understanding. So that's why they are that way. And also that when we make a generic reference to a person, that's either side of the case, right? That's the contractor or the injured party or alleged injured party, as well as the contractor's personnel, supervisor, anything like that, anyone that makes any false statements that have impact.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, that is correct. It's really not even an addition. It's a clarification of previous language, some cleanup. And yes, anyone involved in a workers' compensation fraud, employer, employee, provider, insurer,
sure,
would be subject to the same types of investigation and potential action and penalties.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Seeing none, we thank you.
Thank you.
We have off net at Fairbanks, Fred Brown.
This is Fred Brown speaking.
Thank you. You are live in front of the committee. Please present your affiliation and your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Fred Brown. My address is 1469 Holy Cross Drive, Fairbanks. I'm the Executive Director of the Healthcare Cost Management Corporation of Alaska. And let me just say at the outset that I'm not concerned about the medical fee schedule language that's proposed, but I am concerned about the proposed fraud prosecution language, because I think it does expand the language which was previously in existence. And we think that the consequence will be further cost shifting, which could occur. We think the system can be better improved and costs better contained by reducing the complexity of our system, and my organization has some specific ideas on this topic. Over the next 2 years, we look forward to working with Director Hall and members of the legislature as we review these ideas. By way of background, prior to becoming the executive director in February of last year, I was a hearing officer for the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board since 1984 in Fairbanks. Many of you know Manuel Fry, who was a longtime president of the Alaska AFL-CIO. He's the co-founder of our organization and helped us develop our current mission statement, which reads in part that our mission is to ensure that workers and their families have access to value and quality-based health care benefits and service. Our organization covers about 26 member funds, most of which are in Alaska, but some are in the Pacific Northwest. We have about 44,000 employees that are covered by our organization, counting their dependents and spouses, that equates to about 100,000 covered lives. In Alaska, we represent approximately 10% of the population of the state. Most of our members are union-related healthcare buyers. Some of our members include heavy construction employers, which participate in Taft-Hartley Trust Funds, and as mentioned, pay some of the highest and best wages in the state. But consequently, these employers also pay some of the highest workers' compensation rates in the state and the nation. Typically, our trust funds are the first to pay medical bills in the case of an on-the-job injury, and accordingly, they hold a subrogation interest and hope to be reimbursed later by the injured employee's workers' compensation insurance carrier. Each time a change is implemented in Alaska's workers' compensation law, often the system becomes even more complex. Expenses increase and the process of adjudication is slowed. These changes also add to the delay before our trust funds are reimbursed their subrogation claims. Moreover, whenever the workers' compensation insurers gain additional leverage in negotiating a settlement with injured workers, the percentage of reimbursement paid to our trust funds is reduced. And this is why I'm particularly concerned about the proposed provision in House Bill 314, which threatens additional criminal penalties on injured workers who file claims. I guess the bottom line of my testimony today is that I personally believe the proposed changes in House Bill 314, which threaten additional criminal charges against any of the parties, makes the system more complex. Instead, I submit we should be focused on making the system less complex and that all provisions added to the underlying House Bill 314 medical fee schedule should be removed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Previously, when I'm looking now at page 3 of the committee substitute, which is black backslash E, where it looks like it's taking out the Alaska statutes 1146, 120 to 150, and putting just Alaska statute 11. What specifically is your concern in that change?
Well, previously the focus was solely on matters having to do with theft by inception. And if you look at anomaly, and now there's an incorporation of all of Title 11, which is all of criminal law, but if you focus your attention specifically at Chapter 46 of Title 11, you will find even only in Chapter 46, I counted this morning, approximately 50 ways by which you could be prosecuted. Of that list of 50, only one of the 50 is theft by deception. And so my concern is that by opening it up to all of Title 11, there are any number of ways by which one who wants to hammer upon an injured worker for not completely are not filing a claim form correctly would have additional hammers by which to reduce the settlement, which would otherwise be owed not only to the injured worker, but to our trust funds through the subrogation process.
Okay. Senator Bundy.
Could we ask Ms. Hall to come back? I'd like to address a question to her.
Certainly. Before we do that, is there any other question of Mr. Brown before we have Linda Hall? Seeing none, we thank Mr. Brown. Please, Linda Hall.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance.
Yeah, if I might, Mr. Chairman. Of course, you'd indicated our premiums are high and our costs are high, and this change that separated the criminal from the civil, what's our fraud rate like? Is there a need to do this, or are all our workers honest in their claims?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I don't have the statistics for fraud. I believe the Department of Labor would have those, but all suspected fraud that occurs with a benefit claim to an insurance company is originally reported to the Division of Insurance by statute, and we in turn refer those to the Division of Workers' Compensation Investigative Team. And I understand that only is about average five to eight referrals a year. So I don't think we have a particularly high fraud rate. We have uninsured employers. We have a variety of things that are investigated, but I don't think our fraud rate is particularly high.
If I might, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I know we do have Susan McLean from the Criminal Law Division that is here to testify, and so
okay, I'll hold my question for Mr.
You know,
McLean.
I think that may be the
yeah,
more appropriate
thank you.
Person.
Okay,
so.
but for the record, I'm pleased to hear that we do not have a particularly high rate.
So I know Susan McLean from the Criminal Law Division is here, and so we would certainly welcome you.
Thank you.
Please state your name and affiliation, and there's been some testimony both by Fred Brown as to the changes from 1146.120 to 150 to generally under Alaska Statute Title 11, and then with the fraud issue. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sue McLean. I'm the Director of the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and I also supervise the Office of Special Prosecutions, which is the office that handles criminal prosecutions under the workers' compensation of workers' compensation fraud, for lack of a better word. I am a bit mystified by Mr. Brown's concern, and I'm trying to think it through. The reason for changing this language is because the prior language only left open to the Department of Law. Let me back up a little bit. For someone to be prosecuted, whether that be an employer, a medical provider, or an employee who is making fraudulent statements or dishonest statements, we have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that what they did was fraudulent, not you know, it's either knowing or intentional. It's not negligent, and I don't think that we're talking about simply, you know, not filling out forms correctly. We're talking about our burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that someone tried to take money in one way or another that they were not entitled to. So when the former statute limited prosecutions to the crime of theft by deception, and not everything that people do that is dishonest falls within the definition of theft by deception. It might be, for example, another Title 46 crime. It might be falsification of business records, say it was a doctor. It might be theft by failure to make disposition of funds. You know, if it was an employer who took money but didn't contribute as the employer should to the workers' comp fund. So it simply limited the ability to prosecute into a situation where if you can't prove the elements of that very crime, theft by deception, then you can't file a charge. And so limiting just to Title 1146 theft, the law is when the state charges theft, it isn't necessary for us to specify a theory of theft. We do usually, but often there is more than one theory, and it's not necessary to be limited to one. So that was one of the problems with the statute. The other problem is that it's very clearly spells out the conduct in Section 2, what it is that's prohibited, what people can't do, knowingly make false or misleading statements, knowingly aid or abet someone else in making false statements, misclassify the employees to avoid your duties to your employees. For those actions, the statute lists a mental state of knowingly, but it may be that the conduct falls within a different criminal statute entitled, in theft, the mental state is intentionally. But it might be that you'd see conduct that fell within a criminal statute for which the mental state was knowingly. But certainly, the main point I want to make here is that the purpose of the criminal statute is to address those people who are not being honest and are on purpose not being honest. It's not to address people who don't fill out forms properly. I mean, that would seem to me to be an obvious defense and one which probably wouldn't get past our screening. I'm not sure if I've answered the question completely, but
I think if I could just ask, do you favor this bill as written?
Do I favor this change to prosecution under AS 11?
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Senator Bundy had a follow-up question.
Yeah, and thank you. And again, not being highly conversant in the law, but the concern about using the law to harass people who made a claim, whether they're workers or business owners, in this section of law, does probable cause still apply before you could bring any action?
Yes.
Yeah, so.
Absolutely. And the standard is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, it's not a goal of criminal prosecution to harass people.
Yeah. And the threshold for prosecution under criminal prosecution is higher than civil.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions for Susan McLean, Criminal Division of the Department of Law?
Thank you.
Seeing none, we thank you very much. We have also off net, we have Michael Jensen. Are you available?
Yes, this is Michael Jensen.
Please state your affiliation and your testimony.
My name is Michael Jensen. I am a solo practitioner with the law offices of Michael Jensen here in Anchorage, Alaska. I've been in the practice in Alaska for 25 years, representing exclusively injured Alaska workers. Prior to that, I was in the U.S. Army. I was a prosecutor for 3 years with the U.S. Army before coming to Alaska and working here. And I have, in my role as representing Alaska injured workers, I have first a concern regarding Section 1. We know, in my opinion, what I'm concerned about is that it will affect the workers' ability to obtain medical care. One way, apparently, that we've seen a way of saving money is simply to slash the amount of treatment that a worker can obtain. Medicare is the classic example where that has used the same approach that, in effect, this act envisioned. Medicare has saved money simply by not allowing doctors to recoup even the basic costs of their overhead. And when a person over 65 wants to find a doctor in Alaska, they simply can't. And I'm afraid that Section 1, it may have the unintended effect of, in its zeal to save money, the unintended effect to make it more difficult for workers to obtain medical care. There was a statement made that everyone was happy with this bill, that the Medical Services Review Committee supported this bill. I have a copy of a letter sent by three doctors to the legislature on February 2nd, 2010. They're Drs. Gavart, James, Levine, Johnston, all physical medicine doctors. And on page 2 of their letter, they state, it is unfortunate that none of the committee's recommendations are included in HB 314. The committee to which they're referring is the Medical Services Review Committee. The Alaska State Medical Association on February 1st, 2010 also wrote to the legislature, and it also stated that the Alaska Medical Association will limit its comments and opposes the adoption of the act. I don't think everyone was happy with it. Even I don't think the Department of Labor was happy with the process, since in House Bill 346 they're seeking to abolish the Medical Services Review Committee. I did want to, though, however, concentrate my comments on sections 2 and 3. First, I don't think those sections should be part of a fee schedule bill. I think those sections should be referred to judiciary so that the consequences of and the what these amendments, the results that they can or effects that they can have on injured workers and providers can be more fully studied. I noticed that there is no figure as to what the cost for the new anticipated prosecutions will be to the Department of Law. What I'm concerned about, though, is particularly Section A4. I understand that it's only being modified slightly, but A4 is very vague. I can't comprehend who it applies to. I do understand that the section is simply adding potentially 49 new offenses to the current offense of theft by deception, but who does it apply to? Who risks prosecution? And yes, it's true that prosecution uses a standard of proof beyond reasonable doubt, but the section 2 and 3 also envision civil actions, and civil actions have a much lower threshold of proof. Does the section permit insurance companies to pursue unrepresented workers who can't afford lawyers to defend them in a civil action? Also, do doctors and therapists risk prosecution or civil action if they make the mistake of believing their patients and encourage them to file for benefits? Do employers risk prosecution or civil action if they encourage one of their employees to file for workers' compensation benefits if the employer feels that the worker suffered an injury at work? And as a personal concern, do lawyers who believe their clients and pursue the claim on their behalf risk prosecution or civil action? The statute simply, the language is simply so vague that I don't know who it applies to and how it would be applied. Are we all, are doctors, therapists, lawyers, and even employers risking the threat of a lawsuit by an insurance company acting on behalf of the insurance company's interests, or are they risking even more severe consequences such as prosecution? And the fact that a civil act, that prosecution has a proof beyond reasonable doubt standard is little comfort to somebody who's facing a civil action that can cost the person thousands of dollars in legal fees, where the standard of proof is much lower. Thank you. That's all the comments I wish to make.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Any questions of Mr. Jensen? Seeing none, we move to Steve Constantino.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Constantino. I'm a former hearing officer with the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board, and for the last decade, I am in solo private practice representing injured workers in comp cases. With regard to the first section of the bill, I don't entirely agree with my colleague, Mr. Jensen, with all due respect. However, I would like to note that we are simply, with this change, going back to the old system that was in place where we actually did have a schedule of fees, an Alaska schedule of fees based on Alaska charges. One thing that I would like to see in the law is that once this fee schedule is actually created, that the public has access to it. In the past, this has been treated as a proprietary document, so that there were special coding companies that bought it, and some insurance companies submitted their bills to the coding company, but injured workers didn't have access to the fee schedule. I'm sure there's some physicians that could afford it, but if this is to be made into law, and we are going to have a fee schedule again, and I'm not speaking against the idea of a fee schedule, I'm simply advocating that since the state is going to pay for the study that produces it, that it be a public document that the medical profession, the legal profession, and individual Alaskans can see whether or not what their fees are, what the fees are, and whether or not those fees are actually being paid as represented. Primary concern with the bill relates to Section 2. I would echo Mr. Jensen's comments concerning Section 2A4. And again, I appreciate that this is that the change in this is only changing from theft by deception to all of the entirety of Title 11. However, I think that the existing language is vague, and I join my colleague in saying I don't understand what it means. Ms. Hall said that it was her information. There were 5 to 8 referrals per year of the 30,000 work injuries that we have every year. Anecdotally, I would say that our fraud rate is very low. I've actually practiced workers' compensation law decades ago in another state where fraud was rampant. And I think we all agree that fraud by injured workers or by insurers or by employers is something reprehensible that our law should prohibit. However, I think the legislature needs to be cognizant of the fact that the current fraud statutes are being used as a way to intimidate workers out of prosecuting or pursuing legitimate claims. And I wish that the world were black and white, and that we, when we see fraud, we know it. And sometimes we do, but there's a big gray area in the middle where an insurer may take a video of someone that they think is very probative of physical abilities beyond what the worker has represented to his doctor. And I've represented workers in a number of cases like that. And when those allegations or the films themselves are actually shown to neutral third parties, I've yet to have a case where they, the neutral third party, whether it be the board or the board's physician, says, aha, this is fraud. Nevertheless, I'm most acutely concerned for the unrepresented worker, and that's one-third of the litigants in the workers' compensation system. I know from personal experience and from anecdotal experience of my colleagues that fraud is being alleged to basically intimidate injured workers from bringing legitimate claims. So I am encouraging the legislature to move very cautiously in amending the fraud provisions. And again, Section 4, I echo my colleagues' comments. I think it could be applied to doctors. It could be applied to doctors acting in good faith, medical providers acting in good faith, who are taking their patients at face value, patients and clients. I'm also concerned that we have a standard now called theft by deception, and theft has been a concept in the common law for 1,000 years, perhaps. We know what it means. When we open it up to the entirety of Title 11, we include such crimes as unsworn falsification, AS 1156-210 and 205. 205 is really totally the permanent fund. But 210 has an intent, and the intent is to mislead. Well, I have an intent for every one of my clients to persuade the fact finder of the merit of their claim. The only other limitation on that is that I do not believe it's true. Well, that just wouldn't happen. I cannot ethically bring a case that I don't believe is true, but is that a subjective intent or is that an objective intent? I do urge that the criminal provisions of the act that are being recommended be referred to the Judiciary Committee, where the expertise exists to analyze these provisions and to parse out their probable effect on the system. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Constantino. Any Senator Davis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you looking at the CS for House Bill 314?
Up at the upper right of the version I'm looking at in the upper right corner says 26-LSI1354/E.
Gotcha.
Offered out of the Rules Committee 323-2010.
Yes. You referred to Section 4 of the bill?
Yes, ma'am.
I think it's A4.
Oh, it's A4.
It's Section 2A4. I'm sorry if I was confused.
Okay, all right. All right. Would we be having the previous speaker come back and speak to some of the concerns again?
Is that Linda Hall or Susan McLean? Is Susan McLean?
Did she leave?
Gone.
She left.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I think that is her, or Trina Hikas, or?
I'm also an attorney.
Oh, please come forward.
Are you an attorney?
I'm not an attorney.
Okay.
My name is Trina Hikas. I'm currently the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. By way of background, I spent 25 years on the other side of the table for Mike Jensen representing insurance carriers and employers in workers' compensation cases. And in fact, tried cases in front of Fred Brown, who you heard from earlier. Through the chair, Senator Davis, could you restate your question, please?
I was particularly interested in a couple of comments that had been made when he referred to that section that would pertain to the doctors actually recommended that their patients file the complaint, but it might have been forged, but the doctor would not have known it, and they would be caught up in the statute and have to face criminal.
I also spent 2 years as a public defender. I don't see a prosecutor that would take something on that week of an evidentiary string. The physician states that he had no knowledge that the claim itself or the injury reported was fabricated. It's pretty difficult to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And I don't see that a prosecutor would want to waste resources pursuing that.
Was there anything in those testimonies that we just heard that you do not agree with and that you would be willing to speak to that in support of this bill?
Well, I would point out this, the changes to AS 2330-250, let me back up. Before I took this job in December of 2008, the division really had never prosecuted anybody under 250A, which has been in existence since 2005. Last spring, we met with a special prosecutor in the Attorney General's office to get someone designated to take our cases. What was created in 2005 was a special investigations unit who was charged with reviewing cases to see that were brought before them and forwarding them on to the Attorney General's office for prosecution. We were in a position where we've received them from the Division of Insurance. We've also received them from employers and their carriers. We met with the prosecuting attorney, and her concern was that as a prosecutor, it was difficult, if not impossible, to prosecute under the statute as it currently reads, because you have two different intents under the current statute. Every crime has to have, as an element, an intent. And as you read 250A, as proposed under the bill and as it currently reads, we know that a person who knowingly does a number of things, that's the intent element. When you get to the end of the statute as it currently reads, they're guilty of theft by deception, but theft by deception has a completely different intent. It has an actual intent, much as the difference between first-degree murder and second-degree murder. In first-degree murder, I actually intend the consequences of my action, which is to kill. I actually intend to deprive you of something. That is a much higher standard of proof, or a much more difficult standard to meet, I should say. The proof standard is still the same, than to show knowingly. And that was the problem that we wanted to clean up. with this revision. That's what we sought to do. And the other thing, when it was presented to law, they recognized that in this same criminal statute, you have a civil liability. We needed to pull that out. They felt we needed to pull that out. So they did. The civil liability was already there. They created a 250C. And the other was, why limit to just theft by deception? There are a number of other crimes that could fit this conduct, be it by an employer, employee, insurance company, a physician. So just as you and I could be prosecuted under anything if we violate the law under Title 11, which is our criminal statutes, they put it in here to prosecute under AS 11. So I would disagree that this is a problem that otherwise innocent people are going to be now prosecuted. That's no more than anyone in this committee room would be.
If I could ask a more broad question, how many cases do you believe would arise in a year that possibly might be subject to the Section 2 criminal prosecution? You know, I understand you've only been there since 2008, but just what is your general sense of how many of these cases might go from, you know, you got a sneaky suspicion something's going on, but you're going to send it for prosecution?
Well, our investigators, we don't forward it for prosecution just based on a sneaky suspicion.
Right.
The case comes to us. We have trained investigators. The head of that unit is a former police officer. She does a thorough investigation, and only if it meets her standard, as any other police officer would apply, they forward it on. I would anticipate in a year we would have probably, I know that we have received an indictment recently in one case, and there are another five or six currently pending, but we've only, again, just started this process. So I would say no more than 5 to 10 cases a year based on current trends.
I would suspect that the legislature would like to have some information in the future on this, because I'm sure it's something that is of concern. But anyways, Senator Bundy, we have to wrap up on this bill, because we have one more that we absolutely need to take up today. So
very quickly, granting this bill, if it passes, might make the previous attorneys that testified jobs a little more challenging, but do you generally agree with the previous deputy AG that supported this bill?
Yes, I do.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Any further questions of Ms. Hykus? Is there anyone else here today that would like to testify? Is there anyone online that has not already previously testified? Seeing none, I will close public testimony on, thank you, Ms. Hykus, on House Bill 314, and I'm willing to entertain any debate on this. I think the most critical information is that the cap's ready to expire, and we need to deal with the cap, and I don't want to get too wrapped around. Senator Bundy.
If you're ready for a motion.
Senator Bundy.
I would move that we move from committee, I got to get back to look at my number,
314.
The substitute for 314 with attached fiscal notes, individual recommendations.
Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. So moved.
Senator. I can get signatures later if you want.
Yeah, what we will do is get signatures later. We're going to immediately transition now into House Bill 245. So we would request. Hi. So if you, we only have about 5 minutes, and so if you could please state your name, affiliation, and present in its core the bill, and let's get moving.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Casey Schroeder Hotch, staff to Representative Thomas. Thank you for hearing the bill. House Bill 245 was brought forth on behalf of the Board of Optometry. Basically, right now, Alaska has three levels of licensures for optometrists. Basically, it's low, medium, and high. The Board of Optometry would like to get rid of the two lower levels and just have everyone licensed at the highest level. It's students graduating from optometry school right now are already graduating with their credentials to practice at the highest level, and most optometrists in Alaska already have upgraded themselves to be able to practice at the highest level. For those few optometrists who do not have the credentials and do not want to upgrade themselves, they would be issued a restricted license, so they would still be able to practice, but only at the level that's commensurate with their education level. House Bill 245 also allows for a retired license, and I would point out that most states in the nation have already moved to this form of licensure, so this would bring Alaska into in line with other states. I can attempt to answer any questions, or I would also point out that we have Jill Matheson here, who is the chair of the Board of Optometry, and she can explain exactly how this bill would be implemented.
Okay, thank you, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your testimony. It's very good. Just a question on the retired license. So if someone is retired, it's my understanding then that they can come out of retirement and begin practice again, but they have to take a certain amount of education, or what is the requirements there?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps Jill Matheson should answer that directly.
Okay.
Senator Bundy?
And a quick question and a compliment to the bill sponsor, if he's got the wisdom of Solomon, that could, because we've had interesting debates, I want to call them battles, before in this arena. Is there a general agreement between both sides at this point?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So please state your name and affiliation, and if you may address Senator Meyer's question.
Thank you. I am Jill Matheson, chair of the State Optometry Board. Senator Meyer, the board has not come up with any regulations specifically what those requirements would be, but it's something that the board will look forward to. We're going to have a lot of regulation changes if this bill passes, and that would be part of it.
Okay, that works for me. My concern, though, is if somebody is retired for a long period of time, then they go back to practice, that maybe they're not as current as someone else.
Through the chair,
go ahead.
That would be our concern as well, so that we would have some sort of a regulation addressing that.
Yeah, but I agree with Senator Bundy. The fact that you've got both sides agreeing on a bill, that's a day of celebration. Plus the fact we got the administration to finally endorse that previous bill. They've always been neutral on every other bill. So this is a great day.
It's still my beating heart.
I agree.
You know, just in following up along that line of question, is there any serious opposition to House Bill 245 at this time?
No.
And as far as protecting the public interest, do you believe that this adequately protects the public interest?
Yes.
Any further questions by any of the committee members? Was there someone online to speak to House Bill 245? There's no one online to speak to House Bill 245. Is there anyone here in the room that would like to? Seeing none, I close public testimony on House Bill 245. I'm willing to, Senator Meyer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that we move from committee House Bill 245 with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Any objection thereto? Seeing none, it is so ordered. House Bill 245 is advances from this committee as and given that Senate Labor and Commerce is now adjourned, please stick around for signing.